exercises, and small group discussions. Give participants encouragement, useful advice, and hope.
The CreShare videos are excellent.
The video strengthened me.
It's a freeing kind of thing to be able to talk about your loss.
My workbook helped me to unravel the feelings I was going through.
If you know people in your church or community who are grieving the death of a loved one, tell them about GriefShare. Or visit a GriefShare group yourself to heal from the pain of your grief.
There was such a void until I got into GriefShare.
I never really healed down deep until I came to GriefShare.
GriefShare brought me out of my sadness.
Begin your journey from mourning to joy at GriefShare.
Good morning.
Morning.
My name is Chuck Schmitz. Some of you might have known me as Brad's dad for the last year or so. Paul and I are doing a grief share program. Starts February 18th, 6 o'clock in one of the rooms here. Now you ask me, why do you go to grief share? Well, I've had 3 major losses in my life in the last 6 years. And I found myself, grief share has brought me comfort as well as other things. The other thing I would also encourage you to do is today, you could start your journey now from mourning to joy, is you can go to griefshare.org and you could sign up for the daily emails. They give you 365 emails. Brought comfort to me almost every day of my life. So I would encourage you, if you have the time, to sign up for that. And I would also encourage you to come join us February 18th at 6 o'clock. Thank you.
Three through second grade may now be excused for children's Bible time. Don't y'all leave it once now. Come on now. All right, for everybody else that's staying, would you mind standing with me as we sing the next hymn?
All hail the power of Jesus' name. Let angels prostrate fall. Bring forth the royal diadem and crown him Lord of all. Bring forth the royal diadem and crown him Lord of all. Ye chosen seed of Israel's race, ye ransomed from the fall. Hail him who saved you by his grace, and crown him
Lord of all.
Hail him who saved you by his grace, and crown him Lord of all. Oh, that with yonder sacred throne we at his feet may fall, we'll join the everlasting song and praise him Lord of all. We'll join the everlasting song and praise him Lord of all.
Please be seated.
Thank you for being here this morning to bring your worship to our great God. As a church, we're seeking to express gratitude towards each other, privately as well as publicly when we come together as a church. And this morning, I am feeling grateful for a young lady who's a member of our church. Her name is Kirsten Puma. And a few of the things I love about Kirsten is, like, whenever I ask her how she's doing, I get the same positive response. She's living her best life possible. She's just such a positive person. She's devoted to kids. She's a third grade teacher at one of our elementary schools. And I've seen her pitch in kickball. She's a really good pitcher. I was very impressed. And then one more thing, Wes Gordon, one of our elders, said, man, that young lady, she's got her own boat. And that, like, really impresses a fisherman, boater like Wes. So, Kirsten, we recognize the good in you, and we're grateful that God has brought you to our fellowship. So this is the first line in Hebrews 13, verse 4. It says, marriage should be honored by all. All married people, all single people, all cultures, all societies. And I'm not sure everyone honors marriage today as God intends. There's a lot of negative press about marriage in the world today. One writer puts it this way. Marriage made a lot of sense once upon a time, mostly when women didn't have the same roles and rights as men and were effectively private property. A woman didn't have access to the workplace, so she needed financial security. A man had income, but needed heirs. The exchange was simple then, but we've come a long way since, he writes. Marriage, to some people, is just outdated and unnecessary. Some people say that marriage stifles a person's individual identity because you can't just be who you really are because you got to work around another person in your life. Some people say that marriage is oppressive to women, that it puts them down. Some people say marriage is just a piece of paper that really complicates one's life. Usually people who are spreading negative press about marriage have had a bad personal experience with it, either observing someone else's marriage or in their own personal experience as well. But as a result of all of this negativity about marriage today, the world is offering solutions. One is cohabitation. Don't get married. Just live together. This almost never happened in the 1960s where you met a man and woman who weren't married but living together. But it's having you see it a lot today. In fact, 25% of unmarried women today are living with a man. And over 50% of women in their 20s, 30s, and 40s will at one time or another live with a man. So cohabitation is offered as a solution to this problem called marriage. Just staying single is another solution. And today, in our country, more people are single than they are married. So as we begin this morning, in response to some of this negative press about marriage, that it's really not good, and some of the solutions that the world offers as an alternative, I'm going to hit you with about four or five easy facts. Number one, people who live together before marriage have a higher rate of divorce than people who don't. You see, cohabitation doesn't solve that problem of, like, making sure we're meant for each other. Number two, the earlier sex is introduced into a relationship, the more likely it is to end. Three, if you wait until after college age to get married, your chances of divorce percentage-wise are much lower. Okay, you got that one? Number four, most people who are married claim to be happily married. In spite of the negative press that most married people are miserable, according to research, 60 to 75% of married people claim to be very happy. And finally, number five, marriage did not evolve in the late Bronze Age as a way to determine property rights. It began in the mind of God. God created it. And that's why I know it's good. The Bible, in fact, begins and ends with a wedding ceremony. It's just that good. But sometimes we struggle with explaining why it is good. And that's a struggle that one of my favorite TV characters, Ray Barone, had on one episode. Take a look at the screen.
What I forgot to say when I was telling all those stupid jokes was all the good things about marriage. You know, there's just so much good about this. It's like, it's almost hard to start.
Raymond, look.
No, I'm going to get this. Okay, here's something. You know how when you're sleeping and you kind of stop breathing? When you're married, there's always someone there to nudge you alive. All right, I don't know what I'm talking about. Look, this is marriage. You wake up in the morning and she's there. You come home at night and she's there. You eat, she's there. You go to sleep, there. And I know that sounds like a bad thing. But it's not. It's not. Not if it's the right person. Then it's good. It's good. It's really, really good.
So, even though we may struggle at times with coming up with reasons why it is so good, it is, at the very least, because God created it. And for those who simply share negative thoughts about marriage, I want to remind the church this morning that marriage is good. But for those of us who idolize or over-idealize marriage, I want you to know that marriage is not that good. It's good, but it's not that good. And I'll explain over the course of the next few minutes as we delve into the pages of Genesis chapter 29. The chapter begins with Jacob arriving in the land of the Eastern peoples. He's run away from home, and he arrives at his destination totally and completely broke. And he's broke in three ways. One, he's broke relationally. He is all by himself where he has arrived, and he has fled from a number of broken relationships in his own family. In fact, the biggest motive for moving was his brother Esau's death threat. Esau intended to kill Jacob because Jacob had stolen his blessing. And he stole it in a vile way of deception and manipulation at the hands of their blind, aged father, Isaac. Now, deception and manipulation was nothing new to that family. It was a part of their regular family dynamic. His parents, Rebekah and Isaac, played favorites with their children, pitted them against each other. As a result, Isaac and Rebekah were pitted against each other as well, and each lied and schemed, tricked, and manipulated in order to get their way. And that's the kind of family that Jacob was raised in, and so naturally that was the kind of family member he became as well. And so when he arrives in the land of the Eastern peoples, he's broke relationally. He's also broke financially. He doesn't have a penny to his name. Even though he cheated his brother out of his birthright and then blessing that has yet to benefit him financially. So when he packs in a rush in order to save his own life, he's only got the shirt on his own back. And he is just broke without financial resources to support himself in his new homeland. Now, I've noticed that part of the story play out a number of times since I've lived here at the beach. People I've met who have moved here financially broke. And they can't afford their first month's rent. They can't afford to pay for some of the essentials that are needed to live here. And it's always led me to kind of ask myself the question, how does someone move to another place when he or she is already financially broke? And through experience, I've learned that in some cases, people move here to Myrtle Beach under those kinds of circumstances because they are running away from something where they left, just like Jacob was. They were that desperate to leave, even though they couldn't afford to leave financially, they nevertheless did. Finally, number three, Jacob is broke spiritually. There's no sense of his awareness of God and God's presence and God's love in his life, no sense of loyalty or commitment to God. We know that on the way to his new destination, he spent the night at a location where God appeared to him in a vision. We call it Jacob's ladder that he saw in this vision of angels ascending and descending from heaven. Jacob then did have a conversation with God where he attempted to barter and manipulate God to his own advantage. He said, God, if you will keep me alive on this journey, then I will worship you. He's making a deal. And then he says, God, if you will make me really rich one day, then I will give you a tithe of everything. He's not in a loving relationship with God. He is in a managing, deal-making relationship with God because he's also spiritually broke. But when he arrives, he meets his long-lost uncle, Laban, who has a big, big business. And Jacob starts to work for his uncle. After a time, the uncle wants to make a deal with Jacob. And he asks Jacob, what's it going to cost me to keep you employed? And Jacob's answer is, I'll work for you for 7 years in order to marry your daughter, Rachel. Really, that's what he came up with. He's broke, as any person has ever been broke before, relationally and financially and spiritually. And he thinks the one thing that's going to solve all of his problems is marriage to Rachel. If I was just married to her, he's thinking, everything in my life would be fixed. Now, we know that Jacob was smitten by Rachel from the first time that he saw her. Rachel is described in Genesis 29 as lovely in form and beautiful. It means exactly what you think it means. Her appearance, her body, is what first attracted him to her. And the text says that in comparison to her older sister, Leah, there was no comparison. Rachel was just that beautiful, and he had to have her. Now, that kind of stuff never happens today because we're so over looks today. We pay very little attention to looks. We say things like looks aren't everything, but we know it's all a lie because we invest so much money, so much time, so much energy in our physical appearances. It has reached the border of an idol. It is, in fact, an idol in our country today. Looks to many people are everything. Now, I don't think they are, but I think they're something, is what I like to say. Looks aren't everything, but they are something that we should pay attention to in loving relationships, attention to in business and other cultural matters. But right now, at this point in the text, it sounds like looks are everything to Jacob, and her looks are going to fix him. Now, we know back then that people usually did not marry for love. The idea of love before marriage is a fairly recent phenomena in human history. People didn't marry for love for most of human history. They married for status. They married for security. And so it stands out in big flashing lights in Genesis 29 when it does say that Jacob loved Rachel. Doesn't tell us what kind of love, but he does have strong emotional feelings for her prior to their marriage. He is so convinced that she is going to bring into his life everything that is missing in his life that he actually overpays for her. You see, because he's financially broke, he doesn't have the money for the typical dowry price to pay a daddy for his daughter's hand in marriage. And so he offers 7 years of labor, which according to people who know the times and expenses and dowry prices, that he is overpaying for her hand in marriage, which tells us and emphasizes to us again that he really thinks she is going to fix him. He has pushed all of his chips in the front middle of the table just to be with her. So when the 7 years are complete, Jacob goes to her daddy, and this is what he says. Give me my wife. My time is completed, and I want to lie with her. I want to say, dude, you're talking to your father-in-law, and you just said, I want to have sex with your daughter. Everybody knows when you get married, you're going to have sex, but in the language of the day, he is blunt and graphic and inappropriate in the language that he is using towards Rachel's dad, which again in the text is another sign that he really thinks marriage to her and having sexual relations with her is going to fix everything in his life. Ernest Becker won a Pulitzer Prize in the 1970s for his book, The Denial of Death. And in his book, he proposed a theory about what he saw in America at that time in relationship to American citizens' new idolization of romance, of sex, and of marriage. I mean, let's make sure we're on the same page here. Have you noticed the idolization of romance and sex and marriage as it has portrayed in books, in movies, you know, what it is like and how awesome it is and how it's going to just make you the happiest person in the world? I mean, we got Valentine's Day coming up this Friday, and there are plenty of people who think, man, something special is going to happen that's just going to solve everything in their lives just to be with that perfect someone, to know they're loved, and the night's going to be great, and there's going to be dinner and dancing and all kinds of wonderful things, only to discover that after Valentine's Day is over, you're right back to where you were the day before. That stuff's not going to fix you and make you satisfied and happy. So in his book, Becker, who is, by the way, I said, an atheist, says that in America, we have replaced belief in a transcendent God with a transcendent view of sex and marriage. He writes, no human relationship can bear the burden of godhood. However much we idolize him or her, he or she inevitably reflects earthly decay and imperfection. And as he or she is our ideal measure of value, this imperfection falls back on us. What did he just say? No human being can compare to God. And if you're turning to a human being to like fix you and to solve all your problems, like if you were just with that person, everything else in your life would be wonderful. It is a lie. Because no human being is perfect. And so when you replace God with someone or even something else, you will always end right back where you were a day, a week, or a year earlier. So I'm saying marriage is good, but it's not that good. It's not good enough to fix you. It's not good enough to solve all your problems. It's nowhere near as good as only God is. So the story of the Bible describes people who try to replace God with someone or something. And that's the story of us as well. It's called sin. And any experience of sin is really a subtle attempt to replace God with something else or someone else that we think will solve all of our problems. And Adam and Eve, it was the forbidden fruit that was going to like bring them to a higher level of human experience, separate and apart from God. And the story of King Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes, it was work and career that was going to be the solution to his problems. It was going to be education. It was going to be sexual immorality. It was going to be marriage. It was going to be projects. It was going to be lots of things that were going to finally solve his life. And each time he came to the same conclusion. He didn't do it. I'm right back to where I was. Only God is the solution to all of humanity's problems. And Jacob would discover this the morning after his wedding. When he removes the sleet from his eyes and he looks over to discover that he's not married to Rachel, he's married to her older sister, Leah. And again, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, you know, how does that happen? How do you marry and have sex with someone? And it turns out not to be that someone. Well, one solution is cultural dress of the time. A second solution was nighttime vision, darkness, right? That, and the most likely solution is just booze. We know in marriages of that day, it was very common for people to get liquored up. And what I know about that from people who have that experience is that you say and do things, and sometimes you don't even realize where you were the night before. But here's the takeaway. Everyone always ends up marrying Leah. Leah being a symbol of imperfection. I mean, you fall in love, you go through that infatuation stage, and that other person can do no wrong, and maybe you even make it to your wedding day thinking and feeling and believing that. Okay, maybe you make it through your honeymoon, but I'm telling you, at some point, you're going to realize you're married to Leah. You're married to someone who is imperfect. You are married to someone who doesn't have everything you thought that other person had. You're married to someone who's never going to be able to fix you and provide long-lasting contentment, peace, and satisfaction in life. And so when Jacob wakes up, realizing he's married to Leah, the first thing he does is run to Laban. And he says, "What have you done to me?" Now, if you notice the text in its detail, when Jacob offered the dowry price, Laban never says, "We got a deal. 7 years and she's yours." He says, "Why should I allow her to marry someone else and not you?" But Jacob is so fixated on Rachel that he hears what he wants to hear and doesn't hear what is actually said. But the question he asks Laban is, "What is this you have done to me?" It's the same question that both Pharaoh and Abimelech asked Jacob's grandfather when Abraham deceived each of them. "What is this you have done to me?" It's the same question another Abimelech asked Jacob's father, Isaac, when Isaac deceived him. "What is this you have done to me?" And it's the same experience he had on his wedding night that Jacob's own dad had when Jacob dressed up like Esau and because of Esau's blindness thought he was talking to Esau instead of Jacob. Do you see the story? We like to say what goes around comes around. I like to say karma. We like to say you reap what you sow, and what he had sowed with his daddy because of his dad's blindness is what happened to him because of his blindness on his wedding night. He was, in fact, married to Leah. And we all are. And we all have been deceived by so many things in our lives that we thought were going to solve our problems. We all thought an education or a career was going to solve our problems. We thought a family, a marriage, children were going to solve our problems. Some of us thought drugs or alcohol were going to solve our problems. Some of us thought fame or championships were going to solve our problems. And they never have, and they never will. Only God can. I love that line in the movie Jerry Maguire, when after a rocky part in their marriage, Jerry goes home to his wife in front of all of her friends, and he says those three famous words, if you've ever seen the movie. He says to her, "You complete me." And it represents this myth in American society that says that there's this one perfect person out there, and once we find him or her will complete us and everything will be great. But the news of the gospel is this: only Jesus Christ will ever complete you. And Jesus Christ is always enough to complete you, single or married. Jesus is that good, and no one else is. I don't want to tell this story again, but I love the story. If you've been here as long as I have, you've heard the story, but too bad. I'm going to tell it again. You know, I realized in college that I was just dating to date. So as I wasn't alone on Friday nights in the dorm. Not that I particularly like every girl, but just wanted to do something. To not be alone. And I was convicted, I think, now by the Holy Spirit that just was not right, using people that way just to avoid being alone in your dorm room. And so I said to the Lord, okay, Lord, if that's the case, I'm not going to ask another girl out until, one, you teach me how to be okay with just me and you in my dorm room on Friday nights, and number two, she's a girl I really, really like. So I spent the next 3 or 4 months, Friday nights, by myself. You know how lonely a dorm is on a college campus on Friday nights? Whether it's because everybody has gone home or everybody else is out and you're in that cement block dorm room all by yourself. But I wasn't by myself. And I learned how to be okay with just me and the Lord, to put any future relationships in their proper perspective. They weren't going to solve my problems. Only God can. And once I finally learned that lesson, playing basketball on campus, my social club against another's, and during warm-ups, I saw this beautiful young lady that I'd never seen before on our small campus. How's that possible that I'd never seen her? That long hair. Remember that gold Sigma Rho t-shirt she was wearing? And a few weeks later, I learned her name was Diana. And a few weeks later, I got up the nerve to introduce myself to her. And then a few weeks later, I'm a slow mover. I wasn't a player. Like a few weeks later, I got up the nerve to call her and ask her out. We went for pizza, and we saw the Tom Hanks movie, The Burbs, which was an awful movie. By the way, one of the few bad movies Tom Hanks has ever made. But she was the last girl that I would ever ask out on a date. And we would be married now for almost 30 years. You don't have to do some of the crazy experiments that I've done in my life with the Lord in order to get me to where I think the Lord wants to take me. You don't have to kiss dating goodbye for months and months until you know you're okay with just yourself and Him. But before you ever think about getting married, you got to know in your heart that that person is not going to solve your problems. I mean, marriage is good. It is. God says it's good. But it's not that good. Only God is that good. God is so good. We're going to sing that song this morning, and if we can help you in any way, if your walk with the Lord, meet me down front. Tell me how we can help as together we stand and sing.
God.